You guys want to stand up? We're going to read John chapter 5, 1 through 18. I've got it. Thank you, Phil. I think we're resetting PowerPoint. Andy says yes. What an interesting story. So this is the third miracle in the book of John. We talked about the second one last week. This is an interesting passage because the miracle doesn't seem to end as well as the other ones did. Where at the wedding feast, Jesus turns water into wine and everyone celebrates and Jesus looks like a hero. And last week we talked about the Roman official whose son is healed and their eyes are open and they discover that it's Jesus. This one's interesting because the eyes of the Pharisees are opened, but it's not a positive response to Jesus, is it? At the end of the passage, we see that this begins the plans for the crucifixion, ultimately. We don't know exactly which festival Jesus is there for, but Jesus is in Jerusalem at this point, and this is before he comes in for Passover, of course. This is not the Passover festival. You're going to have to excuse me if I cough, you guys. I'm so sorry. But I do have some throat tea. Does this work for anyone else, throat tea? I don't know. ChatGPT says hot water and tea is good for my throat. I don't know. So the thing I want to talk about this week is mercy. Mercy is a difficult concept, and we get it confused with this other word that's called grace. Christians are super good at knowing about grace, right? Say what? Yeah. We get it. So here's mercy. This is my definition. Mercy is Jesus reaching into our life. Grace is Jesus' invitation for us to go with him. It's two sides of the same coin, and they work together. Mercy is when God comes in, our undeserved, unplanned. We could be lost in the world. By God's mercy, he comes in. I was thinking about Lamentations 3 this morning. It says, the steadfast love of the Lord never ceases. His mercies never come to an end. They're new every morning. What that kind of soothes my soul is that every single day, God is reaching into my life. Jesus is coming to me in my absolute weakness, when I have nothing to offer. And then grace is that great invitation. It's the way by which we get to walk in life with him. So we move by grace, but it's mercy that comes to us when we're at our least. I've got a silly story. So years ago, Jess and I, we worked with a missions organization called Youth of the Mission, and there was some dorm housing on the property, and we had 18 to 23-year-olds staying on the property for seasons, and they would go through these training modules, and they'd have work duties, and then we'd send them on 2-month mission trips overseas. It's a really great program, intensive. They learned a lot. But this one morning, somebody was out walking the property, probably having a quiet time and captured up into the third heaven, you know, really sensing the move of God, and noticed on the roof of the dorm building were some chicken feet kind of spread throughout the roof. The person panicked, and they went to the leadership. They're like, there's chicken feet on the roof. And we have worship for the whole community, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, and this might have been like a Wednesday morning. So we go in, and everybody's in worship, and there's this announcement that there were chicken feet on the roof of the dorm building. And because we're so close to Boulder, the suspicion was that these witches came down and cast curses on the building by throwing chicken feet onto the roof. And so we stopped worship, went outside to the dorm building, and we're like praying, casting out the curses of the chicken feet. And we went on about our day. I found out probably 5 years later, a buddy of mine who's a pastor, he and another guy found a really good deal on a clearance package of chicken feet at Safeway, and as a prank decided they were going to chuck them up onto the roof of the building. But it was made such a big deal that they never told anybody. Isn't that funny? I think we get caught up so often in superstition, right? We think about things like witch curses and chicken feet, or silly things like wearing blue socks because the Lions are playing a football game, or don't walk under a ladder. You can switch to the next slide, Asher. Yeah, this idea of if I do this, that's going to happen. We kind of live this way normally. It's cause and effect, right? But somehow we get captured by this imagination of these mystical properties, as if the mystical world, the ethereal, whatever's going on out there, that we have some kind of effect. If we do these things, then the mystical world will come and kind of in be involved. We invoke it, it comes. And I'm not too embarrassed to say that I wear the same blue and gray socks when the Lions are playing, because for some reason it was working until they lost. And then I'm like, I guess the socks lost their mojo, right? Well, I washed them every time, and they kept winning. So I don't know. I don't know what was going on. I think as Christians, we do this a lot. And I'm not downgrading prayer, because we talked last week about the power of desperation and how when we come to Jesus with desperate hearts, he meets us in those places. But we use prayer as this, like, formula, as if it's this way of invoking the power of God. You just cast a prayer over it, and it'll be fine. Jess and I were processing this, too, because she said I could share some of this, but, you know, she's taking this master's course on Christian formation, and she gets all this anxiety about taking tests. She's incredibly smart, has a great memory, but when it comes to taking tests, she's terrible at tests. I'm the opposite. I forget all sorts of things, but I do great on tests, and I can't tell you why. And she always asks me, would you just pray for me before I go into my test? as if my prayer is going to cast a magical spell over her ability to not be nervous when she takes a test. And I'm like, yeah, I mean, I'll pray, but, you know, I just pray for peace. And, you know, Lord, be present, but I don't know how she's going to. Again, it's like you pray for your kids before they do an athletic event because you want them to perform well, but you can't pray for them to win. God doesn't care about them winning, does he? I don't know. No? Yes? Sometimes? But there's this, like, what goes around comes around thing, right? If you invest time, energy, prayer, whatever, into it, then you're going to get some kind of harvest back. I would argue this comes out of a motivation of ours to control the outcome. Maybe you know that. How many of you guys are familiar with the idea of karma? You've heard of karma. If you're a child of the 60s and 70s, then you're very familiar with karma. It's turned into what's now called pop karma, popular karma. It's this Western American concept. It's not really karma. Real karma is a Hindu tradition that's thousands of years old where you get what you deserve, but it's in the next life, and you never really have any idea where you're at, but you're stuck in a certain caste, a location, physically, spiritually, based on previous life things. It's really complicated, and that's not what we mean in America when we say, I believe in karma. What we say when we say, I believe in karma, is people get what they deserve, right? It appeals, I think, to control, to know the outcome, the sense of, like, judgment on something. Now they made their own bed. Now they got a lie in it. I believe in karma. I think that leads me through, the scriptures talk about this idea of pride, right? And Proverbs talks about pride a lot. And I think there's two kinds of pride. That the one we most often talk about is the one where, like, arrogant people, like, are boastful and like to take credit for stuff. That's like the outward pride, the obvious one. It's the ugly pride that nobody really likes. And I'm not talking about, like, being proud of something. That's a different word. You can be proud of peace of heart. You can be proud of your kids. You can be proud of, you know, doing a good job at work. But pride is this, like, arrogant, like, I'm better than you thing, right? You guys know what I'm talking about, whether or not you can define it. But there's another kind of pride that I think this one's a little bit more dangerous than the most obvious one. It's this inner pride that is this inner turmoil about who deserves what. Where you internalize your pride and you begin to make judgments on other people. And you think, I deserve better because I'm good, or they don't deserve that because they're bad. I think it's more dangerous because it's hidden. What ends up happening, and I think this is the key question because we're looking at this passage, through superstition is who's worthy to receive mercy? I think that's where I'm going. Who's worthy of mercy? And you're probably wondering, why am I talking about superstition? Well, here's the thing about this pool of Bethesda. Scriptures don't really clarify this, but academics, you know, when you get into the Greek, that little pool note, it's a notation. It's like a margin. This is the Pool of Siloam. It's got four porticos. You know, people go there. It's trying to let people know, like, what's going on at this location. But there's no evidence, biblically or historically, that any miracles actually ever happened there. This Pool of Bethesda likely was some kind of Roman bath. Maybe there was a spring. We aren't really sure. Maybe the spring bubbled up every so often. And the superstition was, as people would go there, the first one to get in the water would be healed. So we've got this story of this man who's been paralyzed his entire life. And he's sitting by this pool, waiting for something good to happen to him. Because he's been told, if I'm the first one in. But he, after 30 years, finds no healing. Nothing. Until Jesus enters his life. Why did Jesus show mercy to this man? Let's go to the next slide. This, I want to talk about apathy a little bit. Because I think this man had symptoms of what we would call apathy. I think he had given up. So when we look at this, and you can't read the scriptures without reading the story before and after, right? You have to read both sides. The story that happens before this is Jesus heals the Roman official's son. And out of this desperation, out of this prayer, we find healing. But unlike this, this man isn't pleading for healing. He's not begging Jesus for help. Jesus had to go to him and ask him, do you even want to be healed? You've been here 30 years. What do you want? What does the man say? Nobody's helped me. I've been waiting. All these people get in. Nobody comes to help me. Look how helpless I am. Oop. Lost my microphone pack. Friends, this is not desperation like we see in the other story. This is resignation. This man has resigned himself to be sick. Proverbs, again, chapter 22, 13 says, the sluggard says there's a lion outside. I'll be killed in the public square. What's the wisdom in that? A sluggard is unwilling to take on the battle. An apathetic person looks outside and says, that's too hard. I'm going to chill. I'm going to chill in here. That's too dangerous. Not about just laziness. It's about avoiding duty, responsibility, about giving up. The paralyzed man's not just lazy. He's disengaged. He's caught up in this self-pity. And I would say self-pity creates in our hearts cynicism. When we get captured by cynicism, we become apathetic. Because what happens with self-pity, it blinds us. It creates a victim mindset. We start feeling sad for ourselves when we start feeling bad. We think nothing's ever going to change. It's somebody else's fault. You guys know that in your heart? You know people like that? Somebody else's fault. And what follows with cynicism is people give up. You say, why would I even bother? Nothing works. We've got those naysayers in our lives too. Always casting doubts on effort. What's the point? Cynics say. And eventually, like this man, apathy settles in. And this is apathy. It's the attitudes and actions or inactions of a life that has no purpose, direction, or hope. Apathy is the attitudes and actions or inactions of a life that has no purpose, direction, or hope. Apathy is living like nothing matters. It's the slow erosion of purpose. We stop caring because you've convinced yourself nothing's going to change. This is what we see in this story. Not desperation for healing, but resignation to brokenness. And church, what I say here about apathy is this is not a neutral posture. Scripture tells us, do not be apathetic. Why? Because apathy is the quiet surrender to death. Apathy is the quiet surrender to death long before you've dug the grave. We cannot be apathetic about our lives. We ought not to give up like this man has given up. Interesting, because he was so apathetic, he didn't even care to learn the name of Jesus. Did you catch that? Jesus says, get up and walk, and he leaves. And the Pharisees are like, who healed you? He's like, oh, that's a guy, I don't know. You didn't catch his name? No. I didn't think about it. Doesn't that feel so natural, though? Even in my own life, sometimes healing, it doesn't produce gratitude. It doesn't build faith in me. It just exposes my selfish heart. I deserved it. You get a good job or find a great pair of New Balance shoes. I deserve that, right? So this is where we get into judgment. Because an apathetic heart judges. That's what's going on. An apathetic heart gets caught in who deserves what. And for those who are captured by apathy, the attitude is, I deserve nothing. I don't deserve anything. And those who are judging others have made the determination they don't deserve it. Why would Jesus heal this man? Why would Jesus heal this man who's apathetic, doesn't care? If Jesus knows the future, he knew the man wasn't going to know his name. But if he didn't, that might have been a big surprise to watch the man walk off and go, I just healed you. Friends, we really don't understand mercy. Why would Jesus heal this guy? Because I tell you this, if you think you deserve mercy, you don't. But you're also misunderstanding mercy if you think others don't. It's easy to internalize that, isn't it? Once you start thinking about people that don't deserve mercy, then you don't get it. We love to see ourselves as Jesus in this story, but I think more often than not, we're the bystanders, or we're the apathetic man, or maybe even the Pharisee. We walk past people caught up in cycles of sin, addiction, brokenness, self-pity. And here's what we think. If they really wanted to be better, they would do something about it. They could fix this if they really wanted to. I've worked hard for what I have. Why should I help them? They dug their own grave. Now they can be buried in it. Friends, that's the hidden pride that we're talking about. It's not just pride that exalts you. It's that pride that quietly disqualifies others from mercy. Do you hear that? It's the inner pride that doesn't just exalt yourself. It's the pride that quietly disqualifies others from receiving God's mercy. We judge addicts who can't stay clean. We roll our eyes at the unemployed friend still making excuses. We resent the person who always needs help but never seems to change. We do this with our own kids. We watch them struggle and we get frustrated instead of compassionate. We think about the migrants. We go, how dare they look for a better place? We worked hard for this country. There's not enough. Send them home. Who deserves mercy? Who deserves it? I think this is the gospel, my friends. Jesus heals even when people aren't trying hard enough. Do you know that? Jesus heals even when you're not trying hard enough. He meets you when you didn't have your quiet time. He's still present. When you lose your patience on the road, he's still there loving that person. When we have migrant workers being forced out of our nation, God is still showing mercy to them. And he's showing mercy to you. The truth about mercy is we don't deserve it. You don't. That's why it's God coming to you. It's his choice to show mercy. So how do we know this is true? Because mercy is really frustrating. It's frustrating for me because I want to be the judge. I want to determine who's right and wrong. But it's God's choice, isn't it? Matthew 7 tells us, this is Jesus, you guys, red letter. Do not judge, or you too will be judged. This is what he says. For in the same way you judge others, you will be judged. For in the same way you judge others, you too will be judged. That's a fearful statement, you guys. And with the measure you use it, it will be measured to you. The tools you use to judge others are the same tools God will use to judge you. Who deserves mercy? James tells us in chapter 2, judgment without mercy will be shown to anyone who has not been merciful. Judgment without mercy will be shown to anyone who hasn't been merciful. Mercy triumphs over judgment. Here's that word, judgment. There's different degrees, different scales of judgment, no pun intended. This is the Greek word krino. When Jesus says, don't judge lest ye be judged, he says, don't krino lest God krino you. That word means to condemn, to determine as guilty. It's what a judge does when they've made their determination. It's a krino. Whose duty is it to determine guilt? Whose duty is it? Say it. It's God's. But man, that sucks, you guys. Because I got the Bible. I can read this and determine who's following it or not, right? What can't you do? What does this not do for others, but it does to yourself? Do you know? Kind of a trick question. It reveals your heart. But I can't go up to Hannah and start reading this to see her heart. Spirit's not going to tell me what's going on in her life. But it does talk to her. We are not the judgers. We are not the determiners of guilt. We are simply the receivers of mercy. So we ought to show mercy to others. Break here for a second. You guys, I know this is a tough one. This is one of those weird stories that it's like looking into a mirror and you go, oh no, I'm not doing too good. And then something confusing happens later. So after the man is healed, the Pharisees ask him who it was. He says, I don't know. Jesus comes up to him. He finds him later and tells him who he is. And what does he say to the man? Stop sinning. John uses that sinning a handful of times. Every single time, sin comes up in the book of John. It's about not proclaiming the name of Jesus. So when Jesus comes up to this man and says, stop sinning, he's saying, you need to go tell people what I've done. As if healing ought to lead to glorifying God. Right? The man didn't know who Jesus was. He didn't even acknowledge the source of his healing. But there is this call to bring glory from our brokenness. I think that's what Jesus is trying to say here. Bring me glory because I've shown you mercy. I've got a paragraph here from Andrew Murray. He wrote this in 1864. Beloved Christian, I do not wonder if the promise of the text appears almost too high. Do not, I pray, let your attention be diverted by the question as to whether it should be possible to be kept for your whole life or for so many years without sinning. Faith has ever only to deal with the present moment. Ask this, can Jesus at the present moment, as I abide in him, keep me from those actual transgressions which have been the stain and weariness of my daily life? You cannot but say, surely he can. Take him then at this present moment and say, Jesus keeps me now. Jesus saves me now. Yield yourself to him in the earnest and believing prayer to be kept abiding by his own abiding in you, and go into the next moment in the succeeding hours with this trust continually renewed. As often the opportunity occurs in the moments between your occupations, renew your faith in an act of devotion. Jesus keeps me now. Jesus saves me now. Let failure and sin, instead of discouraging you, only urge you still more to seek your safety in abiding in the sinless one. Abiding is a grace in which you can grow wonderfully, if you will but make at once the complete surrender, and then persevere with ever larger expectation. We're talking about abiding this winter, of course. And abiding in Jesus is not about perfection. Abiding is staying connected to him, step by step, moment by moment, knowing that his mercy covers when we don't. Friends, that's abiding. When you're nervous about taking an exam, when you've judged others, when you've failed and you fell back into addiction, when you're caught in apathy, stop and abide. Let the invitation of God's mercy take you into a new place where you can recognize not tomorrow, not yesterday, right now. Jesus, I need you now. Jesus, keep me now. Right now. Because right now, in this moment, can Jesus keep you? The answer is yes. You have to believe it. You have to believe that's true. Friends, following Jesus isn't about figuring out how to avoid sin for the rest of your life. We are invited to trust him in our moment. Every time we feel weak, every time we struggle, every time we fail, don't let it push you away. Don't let it drive you to apathy. Don't let it cause you to judge others. Let it be a reminder to abide. Jesus, I need you now. Jesus, keep me. Do you hear that invitation, my friend? Don't sin. Don't return to the life that left you broken and wounded and helpless. Give him glory. This is where mercy overcomes our efforts, you guys. Jesus doesn't call us to just stop sinning. He calls us to abide. It's this invitation of grace from an undeserved mercy. Undeserved mercy becomes a source of our transformation. Maybe you did dig your own grave. Maybe somebody else dug their own grave. But in God's great mercy, let us not be buried in that grave. I deserve it. I deserve it. Let's not be buried in it. Mercy reaches deep, you guys. Romans 5:8, Paul tells us, God demonstrates his own love for us while we were still sinners. Christ died for us. What a great mercy. He says in Ephesians 2:4-5, but because of his great love for us, God, who who is rich in mercy, made us alive with Christ, even when we were dead in our transgressions. It is by grace you've been saved. Not because of anything you've done, but because of his great mercy. That's it. Why did Jesus heal this man? It's because he didn't deserve it. It's because he wouldn't acknowledge him. It's because he knew the Pharisees were going to come after Jesus. Jesus is willing to take the risk for you. He's willing to go to the depths for you. And you don't deserve it. And that's the beauty of mercy, is you don't deserve it. It's in the very nature of mercy, is it's undeserved. And somehow it comes while you're digging your own grave. And grace resurrects us from the graves that we bury. Friends, we are being resurrected from the graves that we dug for ourselves. Isn't that wonderful? I think this story, it's a weird story, but I think it shatters this notion that miracles are tied to faith. The man wasn't seeking Jesus. He didn't display any faith. He didn't even thank Jesus. Yet he healed him to reveal his authority and his glory, not the man's worthiness. Wow. Who is worthy of mercy? No one. Yet you received it, so go give it. Wow. We invite our worship team back up. Let's bring this last slide up, Ash. You lost it. There it is. Jesus, I need you now. Jesus, keep me now. There's no other time but right now, my friends. The only moment where Jesus is with you is right now. And he's inviting you in by his mercy, undeserved. We are broken, apathetic, judgmental people. And Jesus says, abide with me right now. Let's stand up. Friends, healing is not the point of this passage. It's about abiding. And while digging our own graves, we make bad choices and we're prideful and apathetic. Some go out. And he says, live. Stand up and walk. Friends, the gospel of Jesus is not about deserving it. It's about mercy. And Jesus moves toward the unworthy. Jesus moves toward the indifferent, the apathetic. Not because of who they are, but because of who he is. Mercy is not stronger than sin, you guys. Mercy is stronger than death itself. Let's go into this.